Welcome to the Modern Mexico Podcast. I'm your host, Nathaniel Parrish. On today's episode of the podcast, we're talking about the lasting legacy of Mexico's most notorious drug trafficker, Joaquin Guzman, a man better known for his alias, El Chapo. In 2019, El Chapo was sentenced to life in prison in the U.S., but the Sinaloa cartel that he ran has continued to operate in El Chapo's home state. One of the most high-profile incidents that has occurred in the post-Chapo era in Sinaloa was an explosion of violence on October 17, 2019, when Mexican security forces tried to detain El Chapo's son, Ovidio. PBS News covered the incident shortly after it occurred.
The Mexican state of Sinaloa erupted into violence.
The descent into chaos played out on social media. A phalanx of Mexican security forces deploy to a neighborhood controlled by the powerful, locally based drug cartel and capture their target, Ovidio Guzman Lopez, who now runs the family business built by his father, known as El Chapo, Mexico's most infamous drug lord, now in a U.S. prison. But then the cartel called in the cavalry. With music blaring and phones filming, gunmen with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades raced to the rescue. They deployed a 50-caliber machine gun that's so heavy it's attached to the back of a truck. And the mayhem began. For more than 4 hours, cartel militia members and Mexican soldiers fought in the streets and paralyzed Culiacan. The violence left vehicles burning and dead bodies in the middle of the city in the middle of the day. For residents, it was absolutely terrifying. They fled for their lives, this woman carrying her baby in her arms. And on a nearby road, a father shields his daughter. Daddy, can we get up? She asks.
No, mi amor.
No, my love, he says. This level of violence is stunning, even in a country known for violence. And it's never happened in this city. Here in the capital of Sinaloa State, the Sinaloa cartel, long led by El Chapo, even when on the run from Mexican and U.S. authorities, controlled the city and kept the peace.
Today, we're speaking with Noah Hurwitz, the author of the book El Chapo, The Untold Story of the World's Most Infamous Drug Lord. Hi, Noah. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
So, I'd like to start things off by asking, what's one word that you'd pick to describe El Chapo's secret to success?
I think if you could use one word, it would be impunity. He was able to, like many drug traffickers of his era, he was able to operate for a very long time and be very successful due to a level of impunity in Mexico that ensured that drug traffickers could get very rich doing illegal stuff. You know, he was known for having strong relationships with members of the security forces, with elements of the Mexican state, in areas that he needed to smuggle drugs through. You know, he was originally was able to make a reputation for himself as being a very effective and overall fast smuggler, because of, in the words of one person who testified at his trial, because of his corruption agreements. You know, there was I covered his trial in 2018, 2019, and then spent a year in Mexico reporting on his life and times in Sinaloa. And at the trial, you know, we heard from a number of former associates, and one thing that all of them brought up was that El Chapo and other drug traffickers had really strong contacts within the Mexican state. If you look historically, during El Chapo's time and even before it, there was a system that was sort of system may be too strong a word, but there was a way that things worked that was known as the Plaza system, which was that drug traffickers would have essentially an allotted territory, and it was allotted to them in a sort of backroom deal with the elements of the state that could allow that, you know, with local cops, with soldiers, with judiciary, with politicians. And all of this came together to create an environment in which someone like El Chapo could operate illegally without any true fear of being captured. You know, there was obviously going to be some token seizures of drugs. There was going to be some elements of the state that were actively working against him, but there was also going to be immense pressure to prevent effective law enforcement actions against him. And you know, I think this gets into the way that I think that this undercuts a lot of the way in which El Chapo is seen in popular media, because he's often he and other drug traffickers are likened to these kind of outlaw figures. You know, in Sinaloa, where El Chapo is from, he's often associated with this, this semi-mythical bandit named Jesus Malverde, who was this sort of Robin Hood figure from turn of the century Sinaloa, who fought against the dictatorship pre-revolution. And there's a shrine for Jesus Malverde in Culiacan, where there are, people make offerings to Jesus Malverde to wish them well over a journey. Sometimes that journey is drug trafficking, sometimes it's unrelated. People sell El Chapo merch alongside the Jesus Malverde merch. There's this really powerful connection between Jesus Malverde and El Chapo that really highlights the way in which he's seen as a Robin Hood figure or an outlaw. But as I said at the beginning of this, you know, I don't know how accurate that is, because the role of someone like El Chapo in Sinaloa was much more complex than, it's not some cops and robbers dynamic, you know. It eventually became that to a certain extent, but it was, drug traffickers played, especially I would say historically speaking, a really key role in state formation. You know, the drug trade and the modern Mexican state developed alongside one another and intertwined with one another rather than separately. Scholars like Benjamin Smith have done really great work around this, particularly looking at Sinaloa as a case study for how the drug traffickers in the generation preceding El Chapo had strong links with local political bosses. Sometimes they were local political bosses who ensured a level of stability in the state, especially as the Priista government was trying to solidify its rule over the whole of Mexico, and particularly in the years following the sort of the leftist government of Lázaro Cárdenas in the 40s. So in the 50s, and then definitely into the 60s, you start to see a level of prosperity in parts of Sinaloa that is closely linked with the drug trade. And so to call him an outlaw is at best inaccurate, and at worst just a total misstatement of facts. And you know, one more thing that I'll add is I was recently kind of playing around in some of the government archives that have been released in the past few years. There's a number of files released by the DFS, the Federal Security Directorate, which was the secret police under the Priista government until 1985. Now, the DFS were closely involved in the drug trade, and that's a whole other story. But one thing that I found looking through those archives was a record of El Mayo Zambada, El Chapo's longtime partner, being involved in some basically kidnapping landless activists and torturing them. And I found that to be a really interesting highlight of how, in some respects, drug traffickers sometimes worked as agents of the state or as agents of state terror to ensure the free flow of capital.
So I think that's a really great point. And I think also that impunity is a wonderful word for summing up El Chapo's secret to success in Mexico in the drug trade. And it sounds like from what you're saying that it could be more helpful to think about El Chapo as a politically protected power broker rather than as an outlaw. And I know that one thing the Sinaloa cartel is known for is their business-like approach to extorting legal businesses. And one insight about their influence is the fact that they're also known for being able to protect legal business owners from not just low-level criminals and robbers, but also from government inspectors and government officials. And I recently visited Sinaloa for the first time, and I was there to participate in an amateur road cycling race between the state capital of Culiacan and the mountain village of Badiraguato. And these are two towns that long served as home bases for El Chapo. And El Chapo, like several other top-tier narcos, was born in Badiraguato, and he also lived in Culiacan before he was arrested in 2014. And overall, I think that Sinaloa really has this legendary status within Mexico. And even in Mexico City, many of my friends, I think, would put visiting Culiacan and Badiraguato at about the same level of risk as taking a vacation in Afghanistan. But I have to say, my first impression of Culiacan was that I was really blown away by the level of recent investment and development that the city has achieved. And I think that I imagined that it would be more like a traditional small Mexican city with some flashes of new money. But I think that right now it actually looks more like Fort Lauderdale, Florida than a second-tier Mexican metropolis. So with that in mind, I want to ask, what three words would you pick to describe El Chapo's relationship with the political and business elites in Sinaloa?
I would say that he is complicit, entrenched, undeniable, or he and other drug traffickers are complicit, entrenched, and deniable. You know, as I mentioned before, there have been established links between drug traffickers like El Chapo and El Mayo and business interests that would like to perhaps farm out dirty work to get rid of pesky leftist agitators. Another example that I can borrow from the scholarship of Benjamin Smith is the degree to which the drug trade has not only injected money into the legal economy of Sinaloa, but has also served to prevent collective action that you see in other areas of Mexico that were, you know, that had a large peasant base but were poorer. You know, in the mountains of Sinaloa, for generations, the marijuana and opium trades were a way of providing higher wages to peasants than they might have gotten in legal cash crops. And what does that do? That, in Marxist terms, that prevents the, you know, the contradictions of capitalism from being heightened. It smooths out the edges, and it satisfies discontent that might otherwise lead to peasant uprisings like the kind that you saw in Guerrero in the late 60s and early 70s. But ultimately, I think, you know, for the third word, deniable, it's really hard to prove these things. Money flows around. Culiacan, as you say, is a really fascinating place. You know, they have a there's a James Turrell exhibit in the Botanical Garden. There's a really modern shopping mall. There's all kinds of businesses. It's a city where there's a lot of money. And some of that comes from selling tomatoes. And I think some of that comes from people selling, you know, opium, marijuana, and now fentanyl, and injecting that into the local economy. But it is deniable because it's really hard to prove that. And, you know, you see every so often the U.S., releases what's known as the OFAC list, which is basically sanctions on businesses that are connected to terrorists or organized crime. And you know, you can peruse the OFAC list and see any number of businesses in Culiacan that have been listed as connected to the drug trade. But you know, it's just it's just hinting at the scale of the issue. But again, it is really hard to prove, and unfortunately, Mexico is a country where there's a tremendous amount of violence against journalists, which makes it that much harder to prove, especially the local journalists, who I think are more likely to report on the direct ties between the drug trade and local business. And that's what makes it so dangerous for local journalists. Whereas when I was there, I was doing more of a historical work, and that wasn't necessarily threatening anyone's bottom line, because it's really hard. It takes a lot of digging to connect, to prove those kinds of connections. And so it even if you arrest someone like El Chapo, you don't get to the people who are laundering his money. You don't get to the people who are benefiting from that illicit economy as easily.
So when we think about this very complicated relationship that El Chapo had with the political and business elites in Sinaloa, you picked the words complicit, deniable, and entrenched to describe that relationship. And I have a little anecdote that I think might support those words. When I was in Culiacan, I visited the city's most exclusive cemetery, the Jardines del Umaya. And something that really stands out is that both powerful narcos and local elite business owners are buried there. And the families have built these incredibly ornate shrines, which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And some have Roman columns and look like mini Ivy League university buildings. And others are hyper modern and made from glass and steel. And when you're actually inside the cemetery, you might see well-dressed, wealthy locals who are visiting the graves of their deceased family members. And when I was there, I thought you really couldn't tell who is a narco and who is an empresario. And I think that overlap there is a very important factor to think about. And as you mentioned, Sinaloa really has this legendary status as a narco state in Mexico, but something that I think is really interesting is that we don't see the well-armed cartel gunmen that exist in Sinaloa diversifying out into disrupting legal businesses such as tomato exporters by hijacking cargo trucks, something that is a major problem in many other states in the country. And something that I heard about many times when I was there was that the wealthy narcos are now sending their kids to the same private schools as the children of Culiacan's traditional business elites. And I went and saw the condo that El Chapo's son Ovidio lived in before he was captured. And it does seem like the fact that narcos are living in these very exclusive neighborhoods and sending their kids to these schools is evidence that very, very tight ties have been built between the illegal and legal businesses in Sinaloa. And I think that a lot of the commercial and residential real estate developments in Sinaloa are likely to be beneficiaries of drug money. And with that in mind, I want to ask, when we look at the present, what has the impact of El Chapo's arrest and incarceration had on the Sinaloa cartel's operations?
Overall, it is likely that the arrest and extradition of El Chapo has led to less stability in the state. That was certainly the case in the immediate aftermath of his extradition in early 2017, when violence broke out between the faction run by El Chapo's son, Los Chapitos, and this former lieutenant of El Chapo, whose name is Damaso Lopez. In 2017, a few months after that, after El Chapo was finally extradited to the States, violence broke out in Culiacan between those two factions. A lot of, you know, it was reminiscent of some of the infighting that you saw in 2008, 2009, 2010, when El Chapo and the Beltran Leyva brothers had their final falling out. And you know, that is something that you typically see with the pursuit of the so-called kingpin strategy. You know, you lop off the head of a snake and more snakes pop up. There's less control overall. I will say though that to a certain extent, following that outbreak of violence, Los Chapitos won. You know, Damaso Lopez was arrested. Damaso Lopez's son turned himself into U.S. custody at the border, and things got a little bit more normal. I started this in Sinaloa in 2019, and there were occasional, you know, sometimes it would get a little more hot, sometimes there would be a little bit more violence, but it was generally a lot more stable. And what I think that points to is that ultimately the impact of the elimination of a sort of top figure like El Chapo isn't always going to have a long-lasting effect on the local black market, because there's other people willing to step into the breach. In this case, I think it's important to note that you know, Sinaloa, in other states where this has happened, there has been really long-lasting instability. You know, in Guerrero, which was a sort of a stomping ground of the Beltran Leyva group, when the main Beltran Leyva brothers were either arrested or captured or killed in around, you know, 2009, 2010, Guerrero, there was a serious atomization of organized crime there, and that pretty much continues to this day because no one has really managed to fill the vacuum completely. Whereas in Sinaloa, despite the fact that El Chapo was captured, you know, his sons were there to take on a lot of his, you know, what was left of his network. And there was also his longtime ally, Ismael El Mayo Zambada, who I mentioned earlier, who is, like El Chapo, this really old school trafficker from the mountains who has never been arrested and continues to have a lot of power in the state. And so as a result, El Chapo's gone, but in many ways the infrastructure that he left behind is relatively untouched. Things changed a bit, I think, or the appearance of things changed a bit. Things had been changing by the time El Chapo was arrested in 2016. There was a boom in opium production, because of the rising demand in the U.S. for opioids, which obviously was sparked to a large degree by the OxyContin crisis, and then OxyContin was made really hard to find, and so everyone started doing heroin. And so in the mountains, the price of opium shot through the roof. But by the time El Chapo was arrested, they had also started introducing fentanyl into the drug supply, which fentanyl started to become prevalent in the drug supply in around 2014, and really, by now, of course, it has basically replaced old school heroin. But in 2017, 2018, you see a collapse of opium prices because everyone realized that they could just cut fent into dope and move it north and save a lot of money, save a lot of water, not have to deal with farmers. And so the changes that you have seen in Sinaloa over the past, in the past decade, have been not untouched by El Chapo and not untouched, of course, by his arrest, but have also been, as always, affected probably to a larger degree by external factors. Another thing that I think that you might not have seen in El Chapo's day was the what's known as the Culiacanazo, or Black Thursday. In 2019, October, forgive me for not having the date at the top of my head, but in mid-October, late October 2019, El Chapo's son, Ovidio, there was an operation to attempt to arrest Ovidio. And as anyone who watches Mexico or lives in Mexico will know, it didn't go as planned, right? They managed to capture Ovidio, as you said, in this very fancy condo in a very fancy neighborhood in Culiacan. And then the city just erupted. Gunmen flooded in from the surrounding areas or just materialized from the neighborhoods where they were hanging out. People were burning buses, people were burning tires, they were engaged in running gun battles with security forces. And the whole city was locked down basically until they agreed to let Ovidio go. And now I was not in Sinaloa for that, but I went back to Culiacan a couple weeks after, and I spoke to people who had been in the city for that violence, people who have lived in the city their whole lives. And one thing that I think was really that people spoke about was that it was this breakdown in the established order. Culiacan is a city that is affected by so-called narco violence. It just is. People find ways of navigating that in their day-to-day lives. One student who I spoke to said that he doesn't honk at people in traffic because you never know who's going to have a gun. People find ways to go about their daily lives and either ignore or tune out this underworld that is existing around them. And that was a day where that was not possible. There was essentially an outbreak of urban warfare. And that was something too that, I've spoken to a lot of DEA agents who were working on the operation to arrest El Chapo in 2014 and in 2016. And they were all, one thing that they all said was that they were very fearful or very mindful of the threat that if they did capture El Chapo, that the city would, break out in this kind of uprising, this organized attempt to prevent the arrest and extradition of their leader. And you didn't see that in 2014. And you didn't see that in 2016 when he was rearrested in outside of Los Mochis, which is a town in northern Sinaloa. Why it didn't happen, it's hard to speculate. But one thing that people have said to me in the past is that that wasn't El Chapo's style. He wasn't willing to do that kind of large-scale violence. Whereas Los Chapitos, his sons, are of a different generation. And so I think, in terms of what has changed since El Chapo's arrest, yes, El Mayo is still very powerful, but there's also a different generation in charge. And it's a generation that was raised amid the paramilitarism of the 21st century drug trade in Mexico that sees that as an acceptable tactic. And that, El Chapo did have some turn toward paramilitarism. He did recruit ex-special forces soldiers, in the pattern that was laid out originally by Los Zetas. But for whatever reason, he was not willing to go to those lengths to stay free, and his sons were.
So I think that from what you're saying, it sounds like maybe one of the best ways to sum up the new chapter in Sinaloa after El Chapo's capture is to say that we're now seeing the chapter of history where the Sinaloa cartel is run by El Chapo's sons. And for me, the biggest standout day in this new era has to be the Culiacanazo, which you mentioned, and the video footage that I watched was absolutely shocking. And I just think that visually, the scene of these heavily armed gunmen in civilian clothes running around the city, shooting at soldiers, detaining or kidnapping soldiers, and there are even some cartel gunmen who are riding around in the back of a dump truck that had a 50 caliber machine gun mounted in the back. And I think that just visually that scene highlighted the fact that the Sinaloa cartel is basically a private army. And as you mentioned, over the past two decades, we've seen in Mexico this pattern where high profile captures of cartel capos often catalyze a new era of violence and infighting. But something that I found to be surprising, that I don't think is part of the general discourse in Mexico, is that we've actually seen a drop in homicides over the past few years in Sinaloa since El Chapo's capture and extradition. And on the one hand, we have seen around 20,000 homicides recorded in Sinaloa since 2007, since the start of the modern drug war in Mexico. But I looked it up, and the total number of homicides that were recorded in Sinaloa in 2023 was more than 75% lower than the total from 2010, which was the worst year for violence in Sinaloa in the past two decades. But I think it's really important to state that the Sinaloa cartel continues to operate, and the decrease in violence is absolutely not an indicator that the organized crime groups in Sinaloa have in any way lost power. And we know that the Sinaloa cartel continues to control an entire army of sicarios. And something that's really interesting to me is I know that there's this legend in Mexico that the Sinaloa cartel doesn't mess with ordinary people. And maybe it's true that there is some evidence that might support this Robin Hood type myth about El Chapo. But on the other hand, we also know that Sinaloa is one of the worst hotspots in Mexico for violent carjackings. And it's actually the worst state in Mexico for the percentage of car thefts that involve violence. And because of weak law enforcement capacity and high levels of impunity, we don't really know exactly who is doing the carjacking in Sinaloa, but a general trend in Mexico is that organized crime groups often steal cars such as Volkswagen Jettas and Toyota Hiluxes that they then use in criminal operations such as kidnappings or armed assaults on rivals. So for many of Sinaloa's large group of legal business owners, it seems like the narcos are somewhat uncomfortable neighbors. And on the one hand, drug money has been and continues to be a major boost for Sinaloa's economy. But on the other hand, residents in Sinaloa still have to live in a context where a private army controlled by non-state actors is an important power broker in their community. And another thing that I heard when I was in Sinaloa was that this shift towards synthetic drugs that you mentioned means that right now there are fewer job opportunities in drug production for rural farmers in mountain towns who had been involved in growing opium and marijuana for decades. But I also heard that Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has forged relationships with residents in many out-of-the-way regions of Sinaloa. And he's also implemented social programs that are very popular with many residents in rural areas. And I know that López Obrador's activity in Sinaloa and his relationships with local power brokers has been subject to quite a bit of media scrutiny and speculation, both in Mexico and in the US. And in 2024, media outlets, including the New York Times and ProPublica, have published some allegations about President López Obrador having ties to the Sinaloa cartel and other organized crime groups. And I want to ask, do you think these allegations are credible points of inquiry, or do you think that this is just fake news, as López Obrador might say?
I think it's absolutely credible points of inquiry, and I think that the stories that came out in ProPublica and the New York Times were, I think it could be a useful thought exercise to look to wonder about who is leaking this information and why. But I think that the information that was leaked seems absolutely credible. I find it very believable that members of AMLO's party interfaced with and potentially received bribes from traffickers affiliated with El Chapo or Los Chapitos or other organized crime networks. You know, it's harder to tell if that resulted in some kind of direct quid pro quo to benefit those traffickers. But you know, bribery is endemic in Mexico, and it would not surprise me if members of government, even at the highest level, are on the take to some extent. When I say bribery is endemic in Mexico, I think it's also really important to look at the local level. It's really flashy to say, you know, the president of Mexico would be bribed El Chapo, but I think that where that bribery is most effective is locally, you know, and in systems like, say, the prison system, which obviously has benefited El Chapo over the years. He has escaped from prison twice. You know, he was in prison in the 90s. He escaped in 2001 to avoid extradition to the US. And then he was arrested again in 2014. And he escaped again in 2015. And that doesn't happen without some level of complicity. That doesn't happen without being able to, first of all, have the run of the place. You know, when El Chapo was in prison in the 90s, and again when he was in prison in 2014, 2015, he had a lot of perks that ordinary prisoners might not have, and certainly wouldn't have, and he certainly doesn't have in the US now. And that's as a result of the ability to bribe prison officials. You know, when I was reporting on El Chapo in 2019, I visited someone who was in a prison in northern Mexico, and it was a really illuminating glimpse into how bribery worked at that scale. You know, I remember, I mean, first of all, I had to bribe the guard just to get in. I, you know, it wasn't a huge bribe, but it was like, he was like, you know, if you could give me a couple pesitos. But once I was inside, the guy who I was there to see was running things. You know, he had a pretty nice setup. He had guys working for him. He had essentially the run of the cell block, and he had in his cell, he had a queen size bed and air conditioning. He had a flat screen TV. It was a glimpse into, you know, the way that El Chapo lived when he was in prison. And I think I will always be more interested in these local effects. And I think that is where it really benefits drug traffickers directly. Now, one thing I want to say about, you know, about AMLO and his recent history in Sinaloa, as you mentioned, he has visited Sinaloa a number of times. He visited La Tuna, El Chapo's hometown, which is up, you know, you mentioned biking up from Culiacan to Badiraguato. La Tuna is a few hours farther down the road, and to get there you have to go through a number of checkpoints manned by, I don't like to use the word cartel, but by gunmen working for lack of a better word, cartel checkpoints. And one issue that was really that was brought up to me when I visited La Tuna a couple times in 2019 was that there was this road that was being built that was going to connect these mountainous regions of Sinaloa with Durango and points northeast. And there was a lot of frustration in La Tuna around the time that I was there, because things were moving really slowly, and also because the local government had failed to compensate local landowners who had given parts of their land for the construction of the road. I first visited La Tuna in April of 2019, and actually my host in the town spoke about this and showed me a letter that he had drafted to the then newly elected president AMLO, saying, you know, I think you're different. I think that, you know, that you'll hear my complaints. And he, as far as I can tell, El Chapo did, AMLO did listen to his complaints. You know, he visited La Tuna, he spoke with El Chapo's mom. And my understanding is that construction on the road accelerated. Now, this is an issue that was near and dear to locals, that was also near and dear, I'm sure, to drug traffickers, because better infrastructure means easier to move drugs to other areas of the country. But the thing is that, like, you know, did AMLO push that construction forward as a quid pro quo? I guess it's possible. But that was, as I said, also a direct request of the rural campesinos in the area, who he had promised to help during his presidential campaign. You know, El Chapo, I'm sorry that I keep saying this. When I think about Latina, I say El Chapo. AMLO received a lot of flack for his visit to Lechina. And so you can ask, was it politically smart of him to hang around Lechina like that? I don't think so, you know, if only because it opened him up to that kind of criticism. Unless, of course, it was an intentional thumb in the eye of the DEA, which it probably was. But was that evidence of him being in the pocket of El Mayo or Los Chapitos? I don't think so, you know? So I would say that I find the reports believable. I'm suspicious of the motives of whoever leaked that information. I'm not suspicious of the reporters who did it. You know, I know some of them. I have reported on these issues as well, and I think that it's absolutely a legitimate line of inquiry. AMLO, as we all know, has not had the best relationship with the press throughout his term in power. And that has included sometimes just lying. You know, he has insisted that fentanyl is not being produced in Sinaloa, which is absurd. I've seen it myself. I've spoken with traffickers operating in the state who either manufactured it there or worked to move it north after it was manufactured there. I've been to a drug lab in Sinaloa where fentanyl was either being manufactured or being added to drugs. So of course, you know, that is not true. And his response to the New York Times article, which was in part to dox one of the reporters who worked on it, was a disgrace. And unfortunately, it's been part of a problem, you know, part of a pattern with that he's had this combative relationship with the press.
So this year, AMLO is going to finish his 6-year term in office, but I think that historians and journalists are going to continue to investigate any and all allegations about ties between his government and the Sinaloa cartel. So this year, AMLO's response to allegations about some type of improper relationship there has been to go absolutely ballistic and to use his morning Mañanera press conference to attack the U.S. and attack the journalists and, you know, very angrily respond to any type of allegation that he has an improper relationship with the Sinaloa cartel. But soon he'll be out of office and he doesn't get the final word. So I think that both journalists in Sinaloa and in Mexico City and also in the U.S. are going to keep investigating and writing about this topic. So, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, more information will come out and, you know, we'll have to keep waiting and watching what new information we hear about. But I do think it's pretty remarkable that so many years after El Chapo was captured in Sinaloa, we're still talking about his ongoing impact in Mexico. And with that in mind, I want to close by asking, what's one word you would pick to describe El Chapo's lasting legacy in Sinaloa?
I would say nostalgia. You know, the period in which he held power in Sinaloa and beyond was one of economic development, both in the lowland areas where legal agriculture is a major economic powerhouse, and in the mountains where marijuana and opium, or amapola as it's referred to there, long provided a relatively stable income to anyone who chose to work in that sector. You know, while much of that legal economic development continues, though, particularly in and around Culiacan, communities in the mountains have been suffering for years amid a collapse in the wholesale price of illicit cash crops, particularly opium, but also marijuana, because the illegal market for marijuana has, to a large extent, collapsed. As a result, there's a lot of joblessness in the mountains. There's a lot of migration to Culiacan. You know, in my final trip to Sinaloa in 2019, I spoke with a family of displaced people who were living in this makeshift shanty town next to a garbage dump, and they had been displaced by violence in the mountains and also by lack of jobs. And they spoke longingly of their life in the mountains. And many people who I spoke to spoke with a certain longing and a certain nostalgia about El Chapo as, you know, being, as I said, this previous generation, this old school guy from the mountains who treated people right. I see his role in Sinaloa differently. Obviously, I'm very critical of the. I'm not critical necessarily of that, like the nostalgia that people hold in Sinaloa for him, more of the way in which popular culture has made him out to be more of an outlaw and less of a power broker. So it's not really my place to say whether that nostalgia is warranted or not. But I think that is the overwhelming sentiment toward El Chapo, is that, you know, hey, things weren't so bad when he was around.
So that's very interesting. You picked the word nostalgia to talk about El Chapo's lasting legacy in Sinaloa. And one thing that I heard about in Sinaloa is this theory that López Obrador has in many ways replaced El Chapo as the father figure of the forgotten corners of the state's mountain towns. And as you mentioned, López Obrador visited El Chapo's hometown on several occasions, and he even met with El Chapo's mother. And, you know, he was able to navigate the state and even pass through some narco checkpoints while traveling. But over the last few years, he's also helped lead an effort to introduce new social programs in Sinaloa. And many people, even in Mexico City, might find it surprising that local leaders in Badiraguato are now working to rebrand the town as a tourist attraction. And Badiraguato now has a giant statue of San Judas de Tadeo, a saint who's popular with Mexico's narcos and sicarios. And I actually heard that officials in Badiraguato are thinking about building some kind of narco museum to attract tourists. But at the same time, the U.S. State Department still advises U.S. citizens not to visit Sinaloa due to ongoing risks related to crime and the presence of powerful organized crime groups. So the fact that El Chapo has become a tourist attraction in Badiraguato, but many potential tourists might still choose to avoid visiting Badiraguato because of ongoing concerns about security problems, might help to illustrate El Chapo's complicated legacy in Sinaloa. And I think that El Chapo's double-edged impact is also felt more widely in Mexico. And at the global level, his reputation is complex. On the one hand, El Chapo and the organization he created are responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths on both sides of the border when we tally up the opiate overdoses caused by Sinaloan fentanyl and the organized crime-related murders in Mexico. But over the past few years, we've seen this huge growth in cash transfers from the U.S. to Mexico. And we know that remittance payments nearly doubled from $34 billion in 2018 to $67 billion in 2023. And it's very likely that this surge in remittance payments is partially driven by drug cartels moving money back from the U.S. into Mexico. So I think that this surge of remittance income is also part of El Chapo's legacy. And I think that specifically when we talk about Sinaloa, we see that El Chapo's drug money has been a tremendous catalyst for economic development in the state. But mostly what I heard when talking to people in Sinaloa was people expressing either neutral or positive views about El Chapo. So I think overall his reputation is quite complicated, but I think that you're right in that in Sinaloa, there's still a lot of nostalgia for the El Chapo era of the Sinaloa cartel. And to wrap things up, I just want to say how much I enjoyed reading your book. And I also want to say thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, man, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to take a short break to remind listeners that the Modern Mexico podcast is sponsored by Republica Coffee Roasters. Mexico is known for producing some of the best coffee in Latin America. In Mexico City, one of the best places residents and visitors can buy coffee is the Republica Coffee Roasters Cafe in Colonia Roma. Republica Roasters Coffee is also available for purchase online. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Modern Mexico Podcast. If you like what you heard in the podcast today, check out my book, Searching for Modern Mexico, which is available on Amazon. The next episode of the podcast is coming soon. Until then, hasta luego, amigos.